these are issues that really, really do have such a huge impact on where we're going in the next 20 or less years. I've realized we need to start taking responsibility for that now in order to make sure we have a business by the time we get there.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. This week, I'm joined by Ryan Scott, the co-founder of Dropchef. First, I want to have a quick chat to you about the Entrepreneur Experiment community, which is now live. We have 60 members, which kind of blows my mind considering we only launched it last week. So we have 60 entrepreneurs, aspiring entrepreneurs, and people who are just into business who've joined our online community. If you want to join, go to mrgaryfox.com. It's €99 for the year. That gets you access to some of Ireland's most interesting and helpful entrepreneurs, because the whole point of the community is to help each other out, to help each other solve problems. That'll be a big part of the community, is helping each other solve problems and just basically have a general sense of community during this tough time for everybody. So if you're wanting to start a business, or if you have a business already and you're a fan of the pod, it's a similar kind of vibe, similar kind of people. Jump in, and I would love to see you in there. Go to mrgaryfox.com and you can join up straight away. I look forward to chatting to you more in the community. Now, on with today's chat. Today, we're talking to Ryan Scott, the co-founder of Dropchef. I've tried Dropchef. It's a great business. So essentially, you get all your food sent out to you for the week in the exact measurements you need to cook your meals. Simple. It could not be easier. So even if you're a good chef, I'd consider myself pretty handy in the kitchen. I tried this and I absolutely loved it, because everything comes out just a box, all your meals for the week, everything measured out exactly you need. So it cuts down on food waste, cuts down on, what are we going to have for dinner tonight? All that is solved. It's a brilliant product and it's a really good interview. Here is my chat with Ryan Scott, co-founder of Dropchef. Ryan, welcome to the pod.
Great. Thank you so much for having me, Gary.
As we were pre-chatting there, you were giving me a recipe for your pancakes, which is pretty apt considering what you guys do. So give me a little intro into what you do.
Is that an intro to my breakfast, or is that an intro to what I do?
You can give me an intro to Dropchef, yeah. And then you can give us the recipe at the end. We'll do the recipe in the show notes at the end.
Sounds like a plan. My name is Ryan Scott. I am the founder or one of the founders of Dropchef.com. And what we do is we make cooking a healthy dinner, easy, healthy, sustainable and fun for you at home. So it means that when someone gets home from a long day at work, back when we could leave our houses, when you walk up to the kitchen after a long day of, staring at a Zoom call, that all you need to do is open the fridge, pull out all the ingredients that we've prepared for you, and put them all together as our recipe has outlined. So you can cook essentially from scratch in about 20 to 30 minutes.
Oh, cool. So it's all the ingredients you need. And how does that work in terms of, like, do you say, here's your menu for the week, or do people pick it out and then it arrives? How does it all work?
Yeah, so the way it works is each week we upload a completely new menu. So every week you've got a fresh set of recipes to choose from. You pick your favorites, 2 or 3 or 4, however many you'd like to receive that week. And you also tell us how many people you're cooking for. And then from there, we deliver it to you, in a temperature controlled box, all the ingredients in exactly the right quantity. So where you might buy a cookbook because you've seen a celebrity chef before, and they're great because you get them for Christmas time and it's someone who you particularly like and have an affinity towards. You might cook one or two recipes and maybe they'll become, part of your norm and part of your routine. But for the most part, you don't really follow a lot of them because it's a lot of work, planning, going out, finding all the ingredients, then going home, measuring everything out, realizing you might've missed something that wasn't in your pantry that you thought was. And even then in that instance, when you do buy everything you need, you realize you only needed, a sprig of rosemary.
That's my biggest problem. I'm reading down through and I'm like, yeah. A handful of fresh basil. Where am I getting that? Like, it's just a handful. And you're like, I'm buying a whole basil plant. The amount of basil plants I've bought and thrown out is numerous.
So it's incredible.
It's crazy.
I'm still, I'm still blown away when I walk into the supermarket and I see them selling a whole pot plant for, you literally just need a couple of leaves. It's just like, you're moving and transporting, all of this soil, the plastic pot for it, the plant, and, hopefully someone can keep it alive for, enough to grow to get a few meals out of it. But so essentially we do all that for you. Mm. And by doing that, I'm eliminating your food waste. It means that we can, have a fresher, healthier, and more sustainable dinner with you at a better price than you'd otherwise be able to buy if you were buying all the ingredients yourself and having it delivered as well.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. The food waste thing is huge, because I know for us as well, we used to both be out all day. And you try your best to shop. It's only actually since lockdown that we got really good about it. We've so much free time. We make out a menu now. And never before do we have done that. So to have a service like that, it makes I completely understand it. The minute you explained it, I completely understood it. So everything comes in little kind of measured things, and all you do is just put it all together.
Yeah, exactly. So the bit that you see when you're buying a cookbook or you're seeing a celebrity chef is they have everything there in front of them, measured out by some producer on the TV show. And they walk in after having their makeup done, stare at the camera and put everything into the mixture. And then, so they do the fun bit. What they haven't done is they haven't done the planning around it. They haven't figured out, the nutrient balance of it. They haven't done anything else. They look, fantastic having plated this thing in about, 15 minutes in front of you. So we do all of that other work, that their production team does in order to make you look that good to your partner if you're cooking for someone else or, for yourself.
You guys are on the go quite a while. This sounds like a very new modern idea. There's been a lot of companies launched in the last couple of years with kind of delivering fresh meals and kind of pre-packed meals and stuff like that. You guys are on the go a long time. I remember hearing about you guys from a colleague of mine years and years and years ago. how did it all start?
Yeah, good question. So we've been up and running for, a little bit over 5 years, actually. So myself and Roman started it essentially right out of university after we graduated. We both looked at starting our own businesses separately and realized that we both needed a co-founder and that this was, a fantastic opportunity here that really called and really spoke to both of us, which was helping people to live a more healthy, sustainable life. And we knew that this was the problem, that this is what we wanted to tackle and what we wanted to focus on. And we then realized that there was a business in it as well that we could build around that problem, which was essentially delivering the delivery of fresh ingredients to people. So it kind of evolved, over a few months. Come to think of it, actually, a year before we graduated, we had actually run a test. We ran an MVP where we didn't have anything set up whatsoever. We went around essentially with a clipboard and just asked people if we had all of this ready to go, would they buy it from us? And of course, that isn't good enough because people will always say yes. So then, if they said yes, we would then say, okay, great. Well, we'll deliver it to you next week. Wasn't it and then from there, we deduced that there's enough of a demand of that people will order. The next question was, and will people reorder? Because we needed to make sure that in order for this to work, we needed to be doing a good enough job firstly, and it needed to be solving a problem that it was ongoing in these people's lives. And that was also, an important part of our business model because it eliminates food waste massively. Because we update our menu every single week and you know that you need dinner next week and the week after that and the week after that, it means that we can reduce costs massively and pass them on to the consumer because they can put in their orders ahead of time. And as a result, we are only ordering to essentially the exact amount of ingredients, the amount that we need. So it means unlike a traditional grocery player, we don't carry any stock. So the ingredients are fresher. They literally arrive into our fulfillment center get packed up, and then, you know, a lot of the times in less than 24 hours, they're already out the door and can be on a customer's doorstep. So in order to run it that efficiently, we needed to ensure that we had a suitable number of customers that were going to come back and reorder with us every single week. So that was essentially where it started. We then went through, a few years of complete and utter bootstrapping, making best use of the resources available to us. But on the other hand, we were bootstrapped, but relative to a lot of other businesses, we weren't bootstrapped at all, because we were completely funded. It was just, we were funded by our customers and by revenue, which is just the best possible source of funding you can get.
It's the most beautiful model in the world. A lot of stuff you're saying to me is exactly what I did. I love it. I love that model. I saw the founder of Gumroad. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. He helps creators finance themselves. That's exactly what he said. Best source of funding, sales.
Yes. And yeah, just 100%. Like if you have half a million, 100,000 euro, 50,000 euro, 20,000 euro in revenue, over whatever period of time, that is the equivalent of a 20,000 euro round, a 50,000 euro round, except it's far more important, because it means in the event, you don't get all of it because you've got something called a gross margin. but it means that in the event then that you do need to raise money for another reason, that then you're capable of raising, given in the Irish market and within an Irish context in particular, of a fundraising context, it's very, very different to raising in San Francisco or in another place. You know, investors do want to see revenue, and they want to see proven traction, and they want to see unit economics that really stack up and that you can stand behind. So I think the only way we could have ever have gotten to where we've got to is if we were that focused. On the other hand, that's just solely talking about funding. On the other hand, it works the other way, that if you aren't so focused on your customer, and that you're going to, you could be very well funded and think you're a success, and meanwhile, because you're not as focused on pleasing your customer, it means you're losing a lot more customers. You've got a worse product. You would have been better off had you just focused on trying to have them stick around for longer and giving them a better experience.
How did you get your first customers? That's always a question I love asking people, is how did you get those first, handful, those first 5, 10, 15, outside your family and friends? How did you, you've kind of alluded to it there, just sweat graft, I think is you alluded to it earlier.
Family and friends for us were always very low. We didn't ever blitz all of our, beg all everyone that we had, please give us a go. And in hindsight, we probably should have. We had so many, we've so many friends. We've got so many good people that over the years have used Dropshift, but who I think everyone probably at the start assumed they're grand, they're knocking it out of the park.
Yeah.
But so should have hit that up, because that would have helped for the first two months. But we didn't. And I can remember our first customer signing up and we didn't have a clue where they came from and how exciting that was. But then you realize you've got an attribution problem, because you don't know why someone has signed up. So you don't know what is working. So that was a great day, and then the start of many, many questions. But so from the early stage, one of the most important pieces for us was always word of mouth. So initially we accidentally got a tiny piece of PR when we were just running a trial. One of the people who I bumped into when I was at my clipboard, what happened to be a journalist, who then wrote an article about us, which we were absolutely terrified, because we didn't have a business. We had an idea and we were about to have an article written about us. So that probably got us a couple of customers. And then from there, that couple turned into a few more as word of mouth kept building on that. So there was no real one kind of silver bullet ever where it's like, oh, well, we just had this one influencer who took pity on us, or who or who loved our products so much that they shared it, and that was the, you know, that was the one reason. There have been a lot of things like that that have happened, but there's never been one moment in particular, you know, that was the only reason that we kind of depended on for our growth.
Yeah.
And for us, that was quite important, was to make sure that there was no one channel that we were completely dependent on either. And I think that was also something that we've, you know, a good learning or a lesson from COVID is that you can't, because if you're too dependent on a B2B partnership that, you know, suddenly, you know, catering goes down inside businesses, which, you know, you maybe you'd never have thought of or seen before, and suddenly that decimates you there. Or, you know, so for us, we've always tried to make sure that we've been building as resilient a business as possible as well.
How did you, you mentioned something there about you wanted a co-founder. How did you know you wanted a co-founder?
I think what we both found was that it's very, very difficult to start a business by yourself. There's a lot of different skill sets you need. So there's actually three co-founders within Dropchef. So Roman initially had started it, and then very soon after, then Sam, our third co-founder, joined in as well. Sam was a really good friend of mine from throughout university. We raced together a lot as well. So we knew each other very well and had experience working under, you know, a lot of pressure as well. So I think it was just, a good understanding that, you can't, like, you know, you don't have all the answers. I think you need to be humble enough when you start a business you need to back yourself, but you also need to understand and acknowledge that you can't do everything by yourself. So it was good with Roman as well. It meant that we could kind of split tasks and focus on what we were good at. And the same then when Sam joined, he was, you know, very analytical. So there was elements of the job that were really, really perfect for him. I think looking back, there's probably also, I was very interested in entrepreneurship anyway. So I'd probably, understood that you're more likely to succeed if you do have a co-founder as well. I think Paul Graham might've written a good essay on kind of why having a co-founder is important it also just helps in hindsight. Now looking back on it, it also massively helps when, you know, with all the peaks and troughs that you have on the journey. When you're very high, your co-founder might be low or down about something, and vice versa. It's also true. And, you know, I guess I was quite focused on fundraising, let's say, for about 12 months. And that's a period where, it's like there's very, very sharp highs and very, very sharp lows where, you know, it was very good, because meanwhile, while I was out there doing that, trying to shelter the rest of my team from that kind of zigzag. They were meanwhile, you know, making great progress in a lot of other areas and having their own wins. So it meant that we could all balance each other out. So I think that's really the biggest gain you get from having co-founders.
That's super interesting. I've asked that question to a few co-founders, and a lot of them have said that, like when one is up, the other is down. And somehow you meet in the middle, so that, you know, it's very hard. Like I've been a solo founder as well, and a co-founder, and it's very hard as a solo founder just to keep that engine running at the same time, because you just have bad days and good days, and it's nice if someone that levels you off. So bring me back to the first couple of years. Were you coming from a food background? Where did this idea come from? Because it's a pretty specific idea. I know now it seems very obvious. I love these ideas now because everyone's like, oh, of course, that's obvious. Of course, everyone's going to want food delivered. Of course. Whereas 6 years ago, 5 years ago, that's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I guess my co-founder was always very interested in food and was more was very much so the foodie side of things. I myself was more focused in health and more focused in sustainability. So he was looking at, a business model of, a way of pairing artisan producers and suppliers with customers. Actually, would be very similar or, you know, quite essentially the model of Neighbor Food. I know you had them on.
Just today, exactly. As you were saying it, I was like, wait, is he describing Neighbor Food?
Yeah, it was essentially very, very similar to that. But the understanding that, you know, there was st- still a number of problems that just it wasn't solving for the customer. And that's, by the way, that's a fantastic business. And like, I really, really love what they're doing.
But I think it's timely as well, though. I think 6 years ago, if you had done Neighbor Food 6 years ago,
total flop, totally
different. You know, the right idea, the right idea at the wrong time, still a wrong idea.
Exactly. And I think so we kind of were looking at more so just looking at how we could then, you know, make Neighbor Food into a meal. Okay. Mm. So we wanted to kind of skip a couple of the steps or help people out. So essentially we were then looking at how can you make that into the food that's on the plate and save someone all this other time and all this other hassle and do it in a way that's going to be, you know, healthier, you know, as healthy as possible for them as well. So that's kind of where the focus was on. So we started to do this and then we realized it was pointed out to us after I think we had been up and running for about 2 or 3 months that there was actually kind of a model that was very similar to this that was also growing, except they were doing it. They weren't just delivering one meal. They were delivering 3 meals a week. But quite similar to us, it was a subscription based. So we realized, okay, that might be where, you know, the unit economics of it need to, you know, in order to make it sustainable and to make it so it's low cost enough for a customer, we needed to do look at maybe 2 to 3 meals a week.
You're only delivering one.
Yeah, exactly. For, well, probably for the first, you know, initially when we were doing a lot of our market research and maybe, you know, getting set up, that that would have been what we were looking at.
Okay.
But just that model, you know, or an on-demand service, you know, can't really work in this. And the reason it can't work is because the margins are so tight.
Yeah.
And if you try to kind of go that way, you ultimately you're taking money from someone. It's either going to be very, very expensive for the customer. There's going to be no money, or you're going to be losing a lot of money yourself, or you're going to be depending on someone else to be losing a lot of money, such as a gig worker where there just isn't enough income in it there for it to be sustainable for them. Mm. And for us, it's just a completely unfair model that will just never survive in the long term. So I guess, you know, by process of elimination, we realized that, okay, what we need to do is we need to make it so it's, you know, our average customer will get 3 meals a week and that we can, I guess, deliver to them once a week. So they've got everything, you know, there in their fridge. On the other hand, you know, my philosophy on this is always that, you know, it doesn't need to be on demand. Okay. Mm. On demand for me is when I walk to my fridge and I open it, and it's already there.
The old school on demand.
Yeah, exactly. The idea that you need to take out your smartphone and then wait an hour or 40 minutes or, you know, 3 hours is, you know, baffling. Like, that's not...
I agree. I don't have the patience either. I 100%, even if I am ordering from a Camille or something, I ring it up and then I go get it. I don't have the patience to wait and exactly for that thing. I just don't understand that. Maybe it's because I didn't grow up in a city or I'm not really a city dweller. Maybe that's it, but I just don't understand it.
You'd think like we, you know, like, yeah, you know, you're obviously an early adapter and you really have your finger on the pulse of a lot of different businesses. I've like listened back through as well. I was going backwards as well through a lot of your back catalog recently. I was like, if anyone is, you know, is or needs to be living that lifestyle, it's kind of you. But so the thing is like everyone has their own different patterns and there's times where things do work. And ultimately I think no one solution is right. I don't think just dropship alone ever works. And I don't think just David will ever work. I don't think there's one thing. I think customers are always going to, you know, shop in an omni-channel kind of fashion and people will do certain things at certain times. And even they may do certain things at certain times in their life as well. And it's about, you know, I guess trying to, you know, capture that and to solve as many problems as you can for those customers. So that's kind of what our focus is on and kind of how we, you know, have built a business velocity on that.
So you guys kept tweaking the model. From listening to you, you kind of tweak it and tweak it and tweak it and tweak it. What was there, I think you alluded to it there, the move from like one meal to 3 meals. Was that the point where you were like, okay, now it's starting to actually get serious traction here?
Yeah, exactly. I think it probably was like a good book, you know, and the book that, hey, I'm going to do my best to avoid cliches. I don't know what it is about business and about, there's so many cliches in business always. So, but like, as in, you know, So, but one book that was helpful was probably The Lean Startup and understanding, kind of how to develop and iterate and, kind of within a business and within a business idea as well. So that was kind of, would have been helpful or quite influential in the early stages as we were building that. So yeah, I think then at some stage, you then have to stop tweaking the model and start tweaking the product. And then it was realizing that actually, when it comes to tweaking the product, people didn't want a very, kind of weird or very kind of elaborate and strange foods. A lot of what they wanted actually was things that, sounded, relatively safe and that they knew that they were going to enjoy. Because they're not in a restaurant. They're not out there. This is typically, we're trying to solve their problem from a Monday to Friday is where we focus on.
Yeah.
And you do want some newness, but you don't want to go over the top on that. So we realized that our customer wasn't, a foodie, that these people, didn't really exist. What we were looking for is we're looking for normal people and people that cared about their health and people that were short on time and people that cared about the earth as well. That we needed to talk to those people and design the product around them. So start tweaking their product so that it could be, they were designed to be cooked a little bit faster, so that they were designed to be healthier. So then that kind of, began a new wave of thinking where I realized that, I don't work for a drop chef, I work for the customer. Mm-hmm. And it's my job to figure out how to help them to live a more healthy life and to worry about the sustainability issue. They don't need to be counting the calories and trying to figure out if something is healthy or not.
Yeah.
And that for us is where we add a lot of value. If you go to a supermarket, you need to, you go in there, you take responsibility for what you're going to buy. If you buy, a packet of cigarettes, they'll look at them and say, well, it's on you. Or if you buy, if you buy a huge amount of processed foods, they'll look at us and say, it's on you and, you're a grown up. And the way I look at it is that, well, actually, no, I'm taking that responsibility myself. I'm not going to put product out there that is harmful to you or harm. And now I guess the next stage within our development is now trying to also make sure that what the product that we're sending out to you also isn't harmful to the environment either.
Okay.
And it's a incredibly complex, problem to solve because there's so many different challenges within it. So that's kind of a pet project I've had in the last year. I began to study in the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership.
Okay.
So I guess I've started to do a postgrad certificate in sustainable business. And it's just trying to understand and unpack all of the different issues, because ultimately sustainable agriculture is such a huge part of the whole issue that, essentially if we all go out and buy Teslas, it isn't going to make the world a better place. And there's so many other challenges. So I guess it's been really, really helpful because, my approach is that someone just needs to go onto our website and just buy and just click the products that they think that they're going to like. Mm. They shouldn't have to take responsibility for the packaging. They shouldn't have to take responsibility for the methane emissions that are because they've chosen the beef dish over another dish. They shouldn't have to take responsibility for other challenges such as a biodiversity loss from choosing avocados or almonds that were farmed in a monoculture, or for the biogeochemical flows from excess use of nitrogen or phosphorus in intensive farming. These are issues that really, really do have such a huge impact on where we're going in the next 20 or less years. I've realized we need to start taking responsibility for that now in order to make sure we have a business by the time we get there.
Yeah, I think you're spot on there, and you're very much ahead of the game. I think people do want to make that that healthy choice, and that now very much, really only in the last 18 months have I seen this really wave of sustainability. It's going to become the choice. There's going to be not like this, like, oh, well, which do you want? Do you want the harmful option or do you want the good option? It's only going to be that choice. But I think now it's still very difficult because you go in and you're like reading the packaging going, okay, where did this come from? Okay, is the package recyclable? No, it's not. Okay, and it's bewildering.
It's a complete minefield as well. And part of the reason I realized it was important for me to study it is that, I realized that, okay, well, you can have something that's biodegradable you might read on the wrapper and you might think that this is a great product because they're making such a song and a dance about it. And then you realize that actually, well, it's still not compostable. And then you go in and you think it's great that it's compostable and you realize that it's still not home compostable. Or then you realize that actually, but still, if you did a life cycle analysis on it, it still isn't as sustainable at times then as packaging that might have been made that actually was oil-based initially, because it's going into an incinerator anyway if you're living in an apartment block that doesn't have proper composting facilities.
Yeah.
So kind of as a business, we realized we needed to look at this and essentially do a life cycle analysis on many different aspects of our business because there's things that we can do that might make it look like we're doing a great job, but ultimately they're not moving the needle. They're just things that the customer sees. So we've kind of looked at redesigning our business under the hood first and then doing all of the, I guess, ancillary jobs as well. But a lot of that is also going to be guided by making sure that we bring our customers along with us and that they understand that like a tiny tweak here or there will have a much greater impact than, leaving out one small piece of, packaging. And, a good example is that we switched to a completely compostable packaging for our herbs. However, very soon after we realized that it was actually damaging them more and they wasn't keeping them as fresh. And as a result was in a way was leading to, or could have led to more waste.
More waste, yeah.
Because
it's a huge issue. It's a massive issue.
You're losing a day of shelf life. Now, so it's about making sure that, where you do make trade-offs, that you're making them for the right reason and in the right place, and that you're not just doing it because so that you can say on your website that this is better. It's a really, really challenging, but it's also, I think, a really exciting space to be in at the moment because there's just so much momentum here as well.
There's been a lot of companies in the last couple of years that have entered the food space. Made you guys go with the kind of the raw, the natural ingredients, as opposed to, you've seen a lot of people move into the packaged foods, so the ready meals that you heat up yourself. What was your decision around just going for the raw ingredients as opposed to that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I guess we've seen over the years, like so many different businesses with so many different ideas and taking a different spin on things. And we've always, taken the approach that, real food is ingredients, that real food isn't, a list of ingredients. And that, if we provided value to our customers by helping them and educating them on how to cook a better and healthier dinner, that they would stay with us for longer. So essentially, part of the product is, of course, the actual product that you get delivered on your door. But we're also bringing our customers along a journey. We're also, educating them, teaching them how to cook new dishes that they'll be able to use and have for the rest of their lives. We're also giving them the opportunity to try new things every single week if they choose, which means that they've got a far more varied diet as well. So I guess that was, kind of part of it for us. If you have a product that's completely packaged and it's sealed and it's just, frozen, it's never going to be as good as a freshly cooked dinner from scratch. On top of that, you're never going to get the variety where you can change a menu every single week as well. So it allows it to work a little bit more fluid. On the other hand, there's a huge amount of customers and a huge amount of people out there that want fresh ingredients. They don't want something that's processed. And the problem is, as soon as you process it in any way, you're jeopardizing the relationship even that someone has with their food. And as a result of that, you're going to put in other ingredients. You're going to put in a little bit of salt just so they think it's, you know, a little bit nicer, or some sort of stabilizer or something else. Or you're going to, you know, you can, when you're doing it, you're making it yourself. Well, you can use minced beef as a lower VL factor, which means more fat in it, because they're not seeing the minced meat in the packet. So it isn't obvious that that's, that isn't very lean meat. Or you're going to, when you're not giving people, the meat themselves, they might not see that the chicken is actually imported from another country, or that the, pork or something else like that. So there's very many factors. So for us, it's all about connecting people with their food so that there's complete transparency over what they're getting and the quality of what they're eating.
What has separated you from all the companies you talked about there? A lot of companies have started, and I agree with you. I don't think you could pay me to start a company in the food space. It really is for the best of the best. It really is for the best kind of entrepreneurs who really have that guts to succeed in it. What has made you succeed? You know, it's quite a broad question, I guess, but when you look back on your 5 years and nearly 6 years now, what has made you thrive in that time? I mean, Drop Chef has grown to be a very big business.
Yeah, I still, I guess I'm uncomfortable saying succeed, as in like for us, we're still day one, we're still starting out. So very, very far away. And just, to be very clear, that's not me saying to, try and sound humble. I really, this is just the start of it. We're still quite young. But I guess the reason we're still alive is just because we're not dead. As in, it isn't like, businesses, you don't go out of business because you've just run out of money. You go out of business because you've given up. It isn't until you actually give up that you go out of business. Were there times we should have given up? Oh, certainly. Like any logical person would have. So I think a lot of people that have started businesses and stopped them did so because it was completely the right thing to do. The only thing that we were good at was, I guess, was just managing to get through those times. And sometimes I might have lasted a lot longer than others, but continued to push. And I think from that we managed to, keep our eye on like the core, on a sort of kind of core metrics that we could to know that we were going in the right direction. And also to have very clear, kind of defined goals on where we wanted to get to and when we wanted to get there as well. So I guess we've always been growing, and I guess for us one of our core metrics was quarter over quarter growth, and just making sure that every week you might not necessarily get bigger, but every month you may or probably should, but at least every quarter was really our focus. And then once you've got that, and once you're looking for whatever percent it is, it's incredible. I guess it can be exponential, so long as you're looking for over 20% growth or whatnot, it could be very quick. So I guess that's kind of been important to us, is just looking at the right metrics.
I'm always interested to hear how people judge it.
I think there's another good Paul Graham essay I think it's called like How Not to Die.
I'll link that in the notes as well.
Yeah, I think it's quite, and I think I remember reading that in the early days thinking, okay, this is, a lot of what it's down to. And I think also a lot of the reason why we managed to get through that was because, maybe it was also the right time in our lives where we could make such huge and such great sacrifices that we wouldn't be able to make at another point in time. If we, let's say, had a family, or if we had other expenses or had a mortgage, definitely couldn't have gotten through a lot of those times. It doesn't mean, so I think when you look at a business, I think in certain circumstances, certain things are going to work for certain people. But so there's no one right or one wrong answer as to when to start or when to stop.
I'm always interested to see what metrics people are using, because it's so important that you have some sort of barometer of success. And I like the quarter on quarter. Yeah. It gives you enough time to make an impact, but not too long that you've entered a death spiral. By the time you look at the dashboard, it's flashing red. What? You're speaking of tough times. We'll address the elephant in the room really quickly. Since March, what's been happening with yourselves? How has COVID affected you?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it was quite an interesting time. So as I mentioned, we were growing quite quickly. And January of last year, so 12 months ago, was our biggest month we ever had.
Wow.
February was kind of following on that trajectory as well. And then from the beginning of COVID, then it then ramped up a little bit further. And the reason for that was we had already scaled a lot of our processes, and we had the capacity in order to continue that. We were already kind of thinking and trying to plan, very great year ahead, or be, a medium performance of a year and a half ahead in terms of capacity and where we're at. That happened essentially overnight.
Wow.
And very close to it. But as a result, it was extremely challenging because, yes, growth is good, but there's, growth is also, it can be expensive, it can be challenging, there's a lot of other things that come with it. We were able to continue to deliver to all of our customers, but there's a huge amount of challenges on our side, because suddenly a lot of our suppliers who were, reliant on, great restaurants to supply to, and all that whole supply chain broke quite massively, where we were essentially one of their only customers that was still buying, and they were needing to buy in specifically for us and go to the farmers or go to the producers, essentially. So as a result of that, we had massive shocks within our own supply chain in terms of just not having the quantities that we needed, and also the pricing also went absolutely haywire. So, yes, it might have been extremely busy, but because of that, it impacted our bottom line, and it was really quite a rocky time for us. And had we not, threaded the eye of the needle, it could have been a completely different story. So that was it was quite a challenging time, but we're now glad to have gotten through it and kind of taken the lessons from it to a stage where we're now continuing to kind of scale on that trajectory again.
I'm really glad you explained that, because I think a lot of people, when they see companies on the outside, they're like, oh, the lads are doing so well. My God, they're up. But people, I think, on the outside, on businesses looking in, don't see those problems. They're like, oh,
completely.
There's a problem with too much growth. Come on, lads. Like, they don't understand all the nuts and bolts. So thanks for explaining that in such detail in terms of like the suppliers and things like that. Cause I think that's the part people maybe struggle with and don't understand looking outside in.
Massive. Like, it's very easy to paint a picture and say, like, it was just a phenomenal rock ship. But no, there's a lot of other challenges. Another one was that we needed to double the site, our footprint, in terms of to make sure in our fulfillment center, in order to make sure that we could have everyone spaced out.
Of course,
and
yeah.
You can do that when you only, you've got four walls. So we managed to do an adjoining unit that just miraculously had come on the market. And so, that was one kind of space where we got very, very lucky. And then but there's a series of other things like that have, been fortunate to have allowed us to get this far.
So looking ahead to 2021, then, you kind of alluded to it there that you've the processes and systems in place. What's the year looking for you? If you're kind of looking ahead now, what do you want to happen in 2021?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think the next kind of phase I think we need to focus on is everything we've built, we really stress test our business and our model and a lot of different elements of that. The next thing for me is really just to go back into, as we've kind of done in the past, we've spoken about focusing on the model and then focusing on the product. And for me, it's really becoming more focused, product focused again. And we know that there's a huge amount of things we need to do and develop and improve upon. So just finished surveying hundreds of customers. We just took a bit of a cohort on, you know, people who, who've been with us over the last 12 months, let's say, or different people who've been with us, who were with us before that, but haven't been getting us recently, to learn, you know, what are the things that we haven't been doing well, and where can we improve? So my next mission, I guess, is to take on all of this feedback and go and start executing and improving the business in every area. So already we're looking to, I guess, you know, take on hire staff around that and to start improving the product and developing new ones as well that solve more problems for our customers. So, you know, kind of one thing I know I need to do quite massively is improve the vegetarian experience, because it's good at the moment, but it's definitely needs to be great in order for us to, you know, kind of sustain a vegetarian customer for, you know, forever, essentially.
So that is the trick for you. It's not to get the customer once, to get the customer for a month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months. If you could talk to yourself, could jump at the time machine, talk to Ryan back 5-6 years ago, what'd be the one bit of advice you'd kind of say to him and go, look, you're looking at this for the next 5-6 years. What's the one thing?
It's a good question. I have lots of friends who have started businesses like recently over the last 2 or 3 years. And I've got, you know, quite a few friends who are about to start businesses as well, all of different sizes and scales. But I think what I've actually, you know, when I look back and think about the one piece of advice that maybe I've said to all of them that I should have said to myself was, you know, don't rush. It's okay to wait 3 months or 6 months. And quite often that might be in order to make sure that you've just saved up slightly more money in order to make sure that you can weather the storm, where you can have maybe a slightly better launch. And also so you can just have all your ducks in a row. I think if you're going to start a business, you know, it's fine to, like, you know, while you're working in another business to, you know, line everything up, to start learning and to start, I guess, the educational process, you know, learning, if you don't know anything about, you know, kind of, you know, basic finance, to just learn some of the basics. If you don't know anything about, you know, what supports are there to help you start your business, you know, to get all those up and running, so you know that, okay, when we go out there, we're not going to, like, you know, I thought initially, you know, someone might have thought initially they can go out there and maybe send an email to a venture capitalist with an outline of their idea, and that they'll think it's great and get behind them, and they'll be the next Mark Zuckerberg. To realize that, no, in reality, they probably need to, you know, hop on a New Frontiers program and do phase one. Even though there's, you know, what they, you know, there might be nothing, they might see it as there being nothing in it for them, but then they, you know, there might be a module on law and the legal structure that most companies should have, and they can then, you know, that might be one learning, and then they might do phase two, where they get some backing and they might learn a little bit more, and they might also be introduced to some other people and some people who really stress test their business, and from there they'll probably improve it, and at that stage they might be thinking about going full time then, and then I guess from there they might make the natural progression into Enterprise Ireland, who will then assist them in internationalizing their business as well, and I guess into the next phase of, I guess, you know, seed funding, and, you know, maybe, and then from there, they'll be much smarter and they'll have a much better idea than I do, because no doubt they're hit knocking it out of the park. So I think it's kind of just, you know, understanding what the journey is going to be. I think I had a good friend who sent me a screenshot of something he saw on LinkedIn, which was, you know, essentially the journey. This is how you start your business. And it was like, you know, get €5,000 to €10,000 in monthly recurring revenue, raise a pre-seed round, you know, of 100 to 250K for at a valuation of €1 to €3 million. then grow revenue to 60 to 100,000 at a valuation of 5.5 to 8 million, and like it was, you know, and for that you should raise about like 500. I was like, yeah, it's just complete and utter bullshit. Like, I'm sorry, like every single business is so different. Like,
that's the lesson. There is no one blueprint. Like, I've talked to hundreds of entrepreneurs. No. There's no one answer. It's good principles. Like, you've talked about a lot of them already.
Yeah.
But there's like looking for that silver bullet. Like, and Twitter and LinkedIn has like a lot to answer for in terms of unrealistic expectations of people, especially around fundraising. A lot of it's skewed to tech as well. And people think that applies to like, you know, a food business or a property business, when in reality, they couldn't be more divorced.
Exactly, and then something like I'm equally as guilty of this as well. So, you know, the number one rule is just don't listen to anyone, or listen to everyone, but just make sure you think that everyone is wrong, or be quite critical, and be critical of everything I've said, even, because I can say that, but then you could, you know, if you're wanting to start a med tech business, you probably shouldn't be starting with, or you may not want to start by building out revenue first, because you may have it might all be about patents, and you might need to get something approved, which can be quite costly before you ever bring it to market. So there's a lot of different spaces. And I think that's where people, try and draw parallels between completely different sectors and industries. And, you know, you'll have it even where you might be a business accelerator, or even a business competition with someone who's got a med tech business that's going to save the world. And you might have someone else who's starting another business. And it might be that the more humble one is kind of the more sure bet. And in the long run, it actually can perform better, because it isn't hinging on, a couple of huge questions that aren't very well understood yet. So there's so many elements to it, and understand, you know, how, when, and why you should start a business.
It's a super answer. Yeah, it really is. Like, just you forge your own path. And the thing about advice is that's a great point as well. Is to listen to a lot of advice, take it all on board. People mean well, but they're basing it on their own impressions. They're telling you memories they've had, and stories they've done, and experiences they've had, which are unique to them as well. So absolutely, take lots of it, take it all on board, filter it down. Does it apply? No, it doesn't. A little bit applies. Yeah. It applies in this situation. It applies on a Monday. You know, just, it's super, super advice.
And I listen to it all. I've loved your podcasts, and there's so many others out there that I listen to them all. And I've got quite a cynical mind, so I'm always thinking, oh, that's total rubbish. And then, I kind of think, oh, actually, maybe that actually is appropriate, or is suitable in my instance. So, by all means, make sure you are contrarian, and you never take someone's word as gospel. And it's always good, if you're talking to someone or asking for advice, to hear them out and to, ask a lot of people for advice, but never think that someone's going to solve your problems for you.
No one is coming to save you. I love it. That's my new thing. No one's coming to save you. Sort yourself out. Has there been a book, Ryan, that's made a big impact on you, either professionally or personally?
Good question. I guess recently, I've been reading a lot more academic papers in the last 6 months because I'm studying then. So I haven't been reading a lot of new novels, but I think probably at starting the business, maybe the few that were really influential with us early on were probably Blake Mikowski, which is Start Something That Matters.
Okay.
He's the founder of Tom's Shoes.
Oh, yes. We haven't had that recommendation before, but I've heard of the book. That's a great recommendation.
Yeah. So that was really interesting, because I guess, starting a business, I think that's probably also another reason why I personally managed to, stay with Dropship, even through all the difficult times, was because always felt like I was working on something that was bigger than myself and it was for other people. So that was, that's a really great book. Or the other one was Tony Hsieh, Delivering Happiness.
Yes. Yeah. Very sad. Like, it's got, very sad story about him recently, but yeah, that's a great book.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess another startup cliche, because I know that's a book that everyone has read, but...
Sometimes the cliches are true, though. As you get a little bit older, you're kind of going, most of them are kind of true. They're there for a reason.
Yeah, exactly. And I think then, in terms of, for your own listeners, if they're, depending on the stage of their own business that they're at, if you're, if you've got a business already up and running, and you've gone through every accelerator that you can, and you're, now raising finance, you're at that stage, probably read something like Venture Deals by Brad Field. That's quite helpful. If you haven't started a business, don't read it. Just don't waste your time. It's pretty pointless. And then if you've read that book, but you're still not able to raise, read, probably Lean Analytics and make sure you understand the levers of your business so that your customers are able to fund you in the meantime or in general anyway, because that will help your business.
Perfect. Ryan, where can people learn a little bit more about DropChef?
They can, if they like what we're about, they go onto dropchef.com and they can have a look at the menu. We're always going to be improving it. So if you don't like the look of the menu this week, have a look at it next week. Give us a couple more months and it'll be substantially better as well.
Where are you guys delivering to at the minute? Just if people are listening, they want to hop on right now and get it delivered in the next week or so. Where are you guys delivering to?
Oh, good question. We deliver to the whole of Ireland, 52 weeks in the year. Yeah, absolutely. So delivery is free as well. So essentially the price you pay is just what you see. There's no hidden costs. And you can order it once and then never again, or every week. It's as flexible as you wish. So you opt in and out whenever you want.
Brilliant. That is definitely unique. Listen, Ryan, thank you so much for joining me today and best luck with DropChef in the next year.
Great. Thank you so much, Gary. It was a pleasure.
If you made it this far, I assume you enjoyed the chat with Ryan. Really good dude. Hope you enjoyed it. As I said, if you want to join the Entrepreneur Experiment community, chat to myself and chat to loads of the guests who've been on the pod and aspiring entrepreneurs who are building their businesses from the ground up, and maybe get that little bit of support you need, go to MrGaryFox.com, join the community, and I'll see you inside. I'll also see you back here next Monday for the next episode of The Idea Lab. Chat to you then. Have a super weekend.